I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Philadelphia resident Tiara Parker and her family arrived in Orlando on Friday for a vacation. Parker, her cousin, and a friend went to the Pulse nightclub Saturday for a night of fun that instead turned into the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history. Parker described the horror to WHYY's Bobby Allen.
20-year-old Tiara Parker, her cousin Akira Murray, and their friend Patience Carter were hanging out by the dancers in the club around 2 a.m. when Parker decided it's time to go. She got out her phone to call an Uber.
Next thing I knew, this shot started going off in the club. My cousin and my best friend ran out, but when they realized I wasn't with them, they came back looking for me. They found me in the middle of, like, the dance floor, and they grabbed me. We got to get out of here, but we ended up, like, piling up in the bathroom with, like, 15, 20 other people in, like, one stall.
Then gunman Omar Mateen walked into the bathroom. Parker and others in there pushed against the bathroom stall door and communicated with Mateen.
He was like, you know, is there any black people in there? And we were like, yeah, it's like 6 to 7 of us in this stall. He's like, I don't have any problems with you guys. He's like, I know what you guys been through, like with your ancestors been through with slavery. All kind of, he's just bringing up some old stuff. And he said, did you hear about the South Carolina shooting in the church or something? I don't remember that. I just said yes, to whatever to please him and keep him happy. But I just said whatever he wanted to hear.
Mateen was shooting at others and then said his gun got jammed. From behind the stall door, Parker thought this was an opportunity to come out and try to stop him. But he regained control of his jam gun and kept shooting.
My cousin got shot in her arm. And my best friend got shot in both her legs. And I got shot in my side.
Mateen left the bathroom. Parker says she had enough strength to text her mother. Here's her mom, Celeste Williams.
She said, Mom, can you please come get us now? And it was like a please really long, and then it was like now really long.
As Williams rushed off to the club, Parker was going in and out of consciousness, several people lying on top of her in the stall.
We didn't know what to do at this point. We was in the bathroom for hours, laying in other people's blood.
Mateen walked back in.
When I looked him in his face, but I guess he must have thought I died with my eyes open. But in my mind, I'm like, he's going to shoot me in my face because he sees that my eyes are still open. But I was able to still see him, you know. And it was just like he looked angry. But then he just seemed so excited to be, like, in there shooting people.
Meanwhile, her mom, Williams, arrived at the club, but it had been cordoned off. She couldn't get answers from anyone. She was in a state of panic.
I turned around and I told my nephew that I was going to stop calling because I said, what if she is trying to hide somewhere and I keep calling her phone? So I just stopped calling her phone.
And Parker says Mateen was screaming about a phone ringing in the bathroom.
You can clearly hear him getting upset, but the phone was actually on the outside of the bathroom. You could see it outside of the bathroom. And then I guess when he realized that he could see it, he just stopped complaining about the phone.
The next thing Parker remembers is one of the bathroom walls bursting open. Law enforcement had exploded a wall, then used an armored vehicle truck to punch through it. Porcelain from the sink slashed her arm. She watched Mateen go down. Then she was helped out of the club. She kept asking about her cousin, Akira Murray, who had been lying on top of her in the stall. Murray and 48 others died from their injuries. Williams says she and the rest of the family will be staying in Orlando for some time. She says recovering from this is going to be a journey for everyone.
All we did was come here to enjoy our vacation and to just have our family time that we do every year. So it's just going to be rough. You know, we're going to need some counseling, and would have never thought in a million years that our children would be laying hostage and shot with the terrorists.
For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
The corruption trial of Congressman Shaka Fatah wrapped up today with closings from the defense. Just back from the federal courthouse in Philadelphia, and joining me live is WHYY's Aaron Mozell. Aaron, start us off with a review of the charges.
Sure. So the government indictment covers a series of schemes. I'll focus on the ones that include Fatah, which is four out of the five schemes. The first one, and perhaps the most headline-grabbing one, alleges that Fatah took an illegal $1 million loan while he was running for Philadelphia mayor in 2007. This is the year that Michael Nutter won, and this is because the campaign was cash-strapped and behind in the polls. Fatah then, with the help of his co-defendants, steals federal grants and charitable donations to help repay part of the loan the campaign uses. Fatah is also accused of using campaign cash to help pay off some of his son's college loan debt. Prosecutors also say Fatah encouraged a political consultant to set up a sham nonprofit so it could receive federal grants. This is to settle up a debt with that consultant. And lastly, Fatah allegedly takes bribes from a wealthy friend looking to become a U.S. ambassador. In exchange, he sends, this is Fatah, recommendation letters to U.S. Senator Bob Casey, Obama staffers. Fatah even hand-delivers one to President Obama himself.
So yesterday it was the government's turn to tie all those schemes together to make its closing case.
Right. So and that took about almost 3 hours, its closing argument was. The government essentially said that Fatah was a quarterback of a criminal enterprise that included four co-defendants that he'd known for years. And together they went on what prosecutors called a white-collar crime spree. And while they weren't all involved in each of the schemes, as I mentioned, they all stepped up to the plate when Fatah called their number over and over again. That's what the government argued.
Today was the defense's turn.
Right. So the defense, you know, Fatah's lawyer in his closing said there was no credible evidence linking the congressman to any of the crimes laid out in the indictment against him. His name doesn't appear on any documents. His signature isn't anywhere. There are no emails or voice recordings that spell out any of this. And so what this all really boils down to, as his lawyers argued, is a smear against Fatah, who is one of the city's most recognizable political names. Similar themes were echoed during the closing arguments delivered on behalf of Fatah's co-defendants. Over and over, it was argued that the government cherry-picked facts and documents and threw logic to the wind to make their case.
It's been a month-long case. What has Fatah's demeanor been, especially toward the end?
So Fatah, basically throughout this case, has been a pretty cool customer. On the face of it, it doesn't appear that he's terribly concerned by the charges he faces. At times during the closing arguments over these past couple days, he was even seen grinning. And today, during a pretty blistering rebuttal by the government, this is the government's final pitch to jurors before they get the case, before they start deliberating, Fatah popped what appeared to be a cookie into his mouth. This is immediately after a prosecutor pointed directly at him while he was giving remarks.
What kind of cookie?
He wouldn't say. He wouldn't say. We did ask.
Look, the case has already cost him his career. He lost a re-election bid to State Representative Dwight Evans in April's Democratic primary. It ended a three-decade stint in Washington. What's next now that the closing arguments have wrapped up?
So now it's up to the judge to instruct the jury on what is expected to be pages and pages of instructions, kind of how they should tackle and look at this case. Which is extremely complex, has a lot of moving parts, a lot of defendants, and then they'll deliberate. It's not clear how long that'll take. It'll probably take some time, though. It could be this week, could be early next week. But we'll have to see.
Thanks, Aaron.
Sure thing.
WHYY's Aaron Mazel on Newsworks Tonight. Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. More than 2.5 years after Superstorm Sandy made landfall, New Jersey continues an effort to reduce the risk of future catastrophic flood damage. Let's assess the State Department of Environmental Protection buyout plan with Fawn McGee, director for the Blue Acres program. Fawn, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
It's my pleasure, Dave. Thank you.
How long has this program been in effect?
Well, it's twofold. Under Superstorm Sandy, the governor put us in place in May of 2013. But we have had other buyouts necessary in Blue Acres from past floods and storms. So back in 1995, we actually began acquiring land for the state, flood-prone properties by the state.
What is the overall goal?
The overall goal is to get folks out of harm's way. We are number three, climbing to number two in federal insurance claims from flooding. So we have recognized over time that presidential disaster declarations and flooding has been a problem for our densely populated state. And so we are trying to go after folks that we've identified through the National Flood Insurance Program as severe repetitive loss families, meaning claim after claim after claim of being just flood prone. And so we're going in using federal dollars to go in and get folks out of harm's way, knock down the houses, and create open space that will absorb some of those floodwaters for the folks that remain.
So to what extent are these homeowners being urged or coerced, or is it purely voluntary?
Absolutely voluntary. The state's dollars are voluntary, and all of the federal funding requirements start with willing sellers. So we only deal with willing sellers. We reach out to the grassroots folks that are tired of being flooded and are looking for ways to get out. We sit down with the local governments, help them realize that there are things that we can offer them, but there would be a loss, obviously, to the tax base or that ratable for the loss of that home. And it's just a meeting of the minds. Sometimes, you know, that last rainstorm or that last flood, it traumatizes folks, and they're ready to move on. And that's what Sandy did.
So how many meetings of the minds have you had so far, and what's the overall goal?
The overall goal with Sandy, the governor gave us basically 1,000 homes that we are trying to acquire and demolish and get folks out of harm's way. We're just about at 850 of funding and applications completed and approved in 14 municipalities and 8 counties. In the state that were affected by Sandy.
Part of the calculus, of course, is risk-reward. It's hard enough to find reliability in the 5-day forecast. Do you have a sense what this hurricane season at hand might bring? And in actually the longer sense, is there reason to believe that there may be another Superstorm Sandy lurking rather than just one per century?
Well, just based on what we've seen here in New Jersey with presidential disaster declarations, we've been fortunate to have gone as long as we have. Watching what's happening across the nation, you know, we're concerned, you know, that eventually it will come. Like I said, we're number 3, fast approaching number 2 in the worst flood claims in the nation. So we are just in a location where storms are going to come. We're densely populated, and so there's not a lot of place for the water to go, so we need to be strategic and continue to work in these low areas to be able to help these folks out. Our severe repetitive loss and repetitive loss claims are in the thousands in New Jersey. So we could be doing this for the next 20 years just to get the folks that are in these low-lying areas out.
Fawn, thanks so much for joining us to explain the Blue Acres program.
It was my pleasure, Dave. Thank you.
Fawn McGee, director for the Blue Acres program, and you can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. A recent analysis of the presidential campaign has documented a lack of dialogue about poverty. Keystone Crossroads' Emily Previty took a look at what little the candidates have said about poverty.
Did you want a meal, sir? One or two? You're allowed 2 per adult here.
Okay, 2 please.
Do you have a bag or no?
No, I don't.
Okay. That's okay.
Jim Bowers and his wife Janet spend most of their days cooking and delivering meals to hungry residents of small cities throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's coal region, using a donated school bus retrofitted to function as a mobile soup kitchen. They call it God's Chuck Wagon.
On Mondays, we serve Mount Carmel from 4 to 5, and then from 5:30 to 6, we serve in Coltmont. On Tuesdays, we're
8 stops in all every week, serving about 600 people.
One meal, one place.
The nonprofit Talk Poverty estimates 1.4 million Pennsylvanians faced a food shortage during a 2-year stretch ending in 2014. During the decade leading up to that, food stamp use increased in 38 Pennsylvania cities, including Shamokin, where we are now. Here, it went up more than 70%, according to the Penn State Data Center.
You know, I feed almost 125 to 150 people a day. I have people who live in tents year-round. I have people who work 40 hours a week and still can't afford to feed their family. I have people who have to decide, do I want my medicine today or do I want to eat? I want to see if who has the plan that will help these people out.
Have you heard anyone?
No, not yet.
Bowers might amount to a casual observer of the presidential campaign, but his perceptions were confirmed by a recent report from the Center for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. It focused on 9 debates between Democrats Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders and found they mentioned poverty but weren't asked about it. Without candidates being pressed about poverty, the conversations left lacking in detail and voters potentially unequipped to make a choice that reflects their priorities, let alone hold anyone accountable. Bowers, who's a Republican, says he's leaning toward his party's presumptive nominee, Donald Trump, because he believes Trump's business background might be the best chance at increasing employment opportunities.
We will provide major tax relief for middle income and for most other Americans.
There will for be families in poverty, Trump's plan would mean just $1,000 more in take-home pay each year, on average, according to his campaign website. Bauer says people struggling with poverty don't seem to be much of a priority to any candidate, Trump included. Which brings us to our next big barrier for those struggling to make ends meet, transportation. Melissa Farrow is a case manager at Central Susquehanna Opportunities, Inc.
It's basically non-existent. We have a bus that goes from Mount Carmel, which is the lowest end of Northumberland County, and it comes through Shamokin. It stops here and goes to the grocery stores and Shamokin Hospital. That's about the extent, you know, and it's limited hours.
Barrow says warehouses and distribution centers offering the best paid low-skill jobs often open up where land is cheap and not serviced by bus lines.
We had one young lady that I'm working with. She didn't have transportation, so she hooked up with somebody to get a ride, and that person, you know, didn't go to work for whatever reason, so she lost her job.
It's unclear how the nation's poorest figure into candidates' plans for public transit. All of them say investing in infrastructure generally will create jobs. Trump's talking about high-speed rail. Clinton's calling for $275 billion over 5 years for transportation infrastructure, paid for by taxing the country's wealthiest. Sanders says closing corporate tax loopholes will help generate his $1 trillion transit boost, and states will decide how to spend nearly 40% of that. Nobody is getting into detail about expanding mass transit.
It's unfortunate that candidates aren't talking enough about this. It can often be a kind of hidden issue.
Molly Nichols is the director of Pittsburghers for Public Transit.
It is vital for our economies and specifically for low-income folks who want to get more access to opportunity and often become stranded in what we call transit deserts, where they, you know, are walking over a mile to get to a single bus stop.
Back in Shamokin, Jim Bowers says it seems like people running for national office, these things aren't on their radar.
People who have the money, they're comfortable. And I believe in today's societies, it's going back to the haves and have-nots.
Emily Previty, Keystone Crossroads, Shamokin.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the four-station project. 3 artists will share the annual Marian Anderson Award honors this year: Kenny Gamble, Leon Huff, and Patti LaBelle. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports.
The 3 recipients are all associated with the legendary Philadelphia International Records: Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff as songwriters and producers, and Patti LaBelle, of course, as a singer. The Marian Anderson Award is given to people representing both artistic excellence and positive social impact. People like Maya Angelou, Richard Gere, and the one-time rival to Philadelphia International Records, Berry Gordy of Motown Records. Executive Director Pat Moran says the award has had Gamble and Huff and LaBelle on its mind for a long time. mind.
You know, arguably, Gamble and Huff have had the largest impact on American popular music of anybody that's ever come from Philadelphia or from outside of Philadelphia. We have these giants in our city that we really wanted to honor this year. This is the 45th year anniversary of their label also.
The award ceremony is scheduled for November in the Kimmel Center. It's not yet determined if Patti LaBelle will perform. However, Mayor Jim Kenney noted that a taste of old-school Philadelphia soul will be delivered on the 4th of July with a free concert on the Parkway featuring label mates The OJs and Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes.
Bringing back some of those old-school groups that, well, if you're old enough, we all danced to in the 70s. Not only did we dance, but we listened to what they had to say. Everybody woke up to what was going on. And if you don't know me by now, you'll never know me.
I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Tomorrow evening, we'll visit a local law school that's expanding beyond the education of attorneys by also serving other professions that need legal training. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight. I own funny moves. I've got mine. Woman, you got yours too.